Okay, depending on your translation, your opening words in verse 12 will be slightly different. The New King James, Old King James, and Old American Standard have "Blessed is the man who endures temptation." The New American Standard and the ESV have "Blessed is the man who perseveres or remains steadfast under trial." So the real question is whether it should be translated trial or temptation, and I've put two little boxes underneath there to kind of show you how the flow would be, because in the first one, the idea is that we are closing out the section. So verse 12 is actually tying back to James chapter 1, verses 2 to 5. And that's how I read it. And I think what he's done is he's added two other things to the trials. One was wealth. What was the other one? Poverty. Poverty and wealth. Are they trials? Can they be severe trials to people? Wealth and poverty? Yeah, Ecclesiastes talks a lot about the different problems that those bring. So the manifold trials or the various trials, and so that's how I take it, but just in case you're using a different translation, I wanted to take just a minute and explain that other people see this as tying toward where we're going. Because remember, it's the same Greek word, but the Greek word has to be changed in the way that it's translated depending on the context, because what do we learn in verses 13 through 15 about temptation? Temptation and God.
Can't say we're tempted by God.
They don't go together. So even though it's the same word, if God's doing it, can we translate it temptation? No, because that's not what it is. It's a trial. So in verses 1 through 13, I think he's talking about trials. And then in verse 14, he moves to temptations, and he makes it very clear at the very beginning, what about temptation in God? He can't be tempted with evil. He doesn't tempt anyone. So this is the same word. You remember in Matthew chapter 5, verses 3 through 12, every one of Jesus' statements starts with what?
Blessed are.
Okay, and we spent a lot of time on that. Matter of fact, I pulled one of the definitions out of my the Sermon on the Mount Beatitudes. I'm not going to take a lot of time on that right now, but the basic concept behind this word is that you have done something and you're being honored for it. Whether it's a blue ribbon in a fair, whether it's a gold medal in the Olympics, whether it is a situation where you're the valedictorian, you've done something, everybody's recognizing it, and now what are they doing to your name? What are they doing to you? They're blessing you. They're saying that you've done something special, you've done something wonderful. But it isn't just the idea of being happy, it's the reason behind the happiness, and that's why sometimes when we read the Beatitudes, we don't really get the full point there, because basically what Jesus is saying is that of the entire human race, who are the people God is looking for in Matthew chapter 5, verses 3 through 12? Those people. Blessed are you if you have a poverty of spirit, if you mourn, if you are hungering and thirsting for righteousness, because you're like the gold medalist. You're the one God's looking for. You're the one God's going to honor. You're the one on the judgment day that God is going to say, well done, good and faithful servant. So blessed is the man. So this is just another beatitude. There's another beatitude with the same word in Acts 20. You remember what it was? Paul quoting Jesus? It is more blessed to give than to receive. And so, same thing. All right, so the person who endures trials. I don't think, basically, according to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, when I am tempted, what does God do?
Run away and escape.
All right, so do I endure it or do I flee it? See, I don't think contextually you can endure temptation. I don't think that's what God... Because the longer you stay in it, what happens? You just got to get out of it. You can't remain in that situation. So I really think that... And of course, you can read temptation. You just have to understand that this is God's... When God tempts, when God is tempting, and that's why it gets confusing, because we don't think of it like this, but did God tempt Abraham? Well, we don't like that term. So what do we say he did?
He tested
him. But it's the same Greek word, or the same Hebrew word. It's just the one is sinister. Why does Satan tempt?
To destroy.
Okay, he wants destruction. He wants murder. He wants to lie. He wants to get people to harm themselves. Why does God test?
So
okay, to help us grow, to strengthen us, to show us what we are really made of. And so this is the idea here. So blessed is the man who endures trials. Okay, so this goes back to, you remember that first thing we talked about? When trials come, how are you supposed to feel?
Joy.
Count it all joy. Because, and I think this is the answer right here, because when you endure temptation or you endure trials, certain things are going to happen. So let's go ahead and turn to page 2. And now we have another word, approved. And this is a Greek word. I really like it. And every time I think of it, I think of that person. You ever watch the old Westerns and the old English shows where you give somebody a coin and they bite it? You ever see anybody bite a coin? Mm-hmm. Why do they do that? Because if they can mark a mark on it, what does that tell them? This is lead. Okay, this is not what it's supposed to be. You're not supposed to be able to do that. And so so then it's approved. Well, this has the same idea. It has the idea of being tested and being found what? Okay, being found to be exactly what it needs to be. That's what, when we are placed into a trial, what's God's expectation?
Endurance.
You can do it. You can do it. As a matter of fact, what did God say in Hebrews 12 about, or excuse me, chapter 10 about that? My righteous one will live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back unto destruction. We are of those who have faith unto the saving of the soul. What did Jesus say about that in the parable of the sower? What about those people who can't endure trials? What does he call them? What does he say about their heart? You got rocks in your heart, right? Rocky soil.
Rocky soil.
The soil, the seed couldn't get in. Why? Because there was something in your heart that shouldn't have been there. So if I can endure trials, what is that telling me and God? I've got a good and honest heart. So approval, and what about Job? What happened after Job got through his trials? Was he approved? And what do we call him now? Matter of fact, James is going to spend a whole chapter on this in chapter 5. He's going to talk about the same thing over and over again. And he's going to say that we consider those people who endure to be what? Blessed. And so we'll come back to this then. So the term approval simply means that if you can get through it and you're still faithful on the other side, whatever it is, a bereavement. I mean, we talked about all kinds of manifold trials, financial problems, health problems, bereavements. There's lots of different kinds of trials. And if we're still standing after each trial, what should we feel? We should feel joy. We should feel approved. We should feel that our relationship with God is on a very strong level. And the more trials you go through and the more difficult things you have to go through, the more approved you become. So, and then he talks in verse 2, I'm sorry, in the second part of the next clause there on page 2, he will receive the crown of life. How many times is that crown mentioned in the scriptures? Just once? No, it's mentioned quite a few times. I've got them all listed here. There's two on the bottom of page 2, and then there's a couple more on the next page. And so what does Paul call it? An imperishable crown. And what does he call it in 2 Timothy 4?
A crown of righteousness.
Then we look at 1 Peter 5, 4, and it's a crown of glory. And then it's a crown of life. And then hold fast what you have so that no one can take your crown. So if you can't endure the trials, what happens to your crown? It's going to get taken away. And so, and that's what we learn from Abraham. When God tested Abraham, he said, I want you to sacrifice your son. Was that a pretty big trial? Yeah. But when did he do it? Next morning, as soon as the sun came up, he's on his way. Because Abraham trusts God and he wants to submit to God. And when he has the knife raised, what does God say? Now I know. Now I know. Now does that mean he doubted before?
No.
I don't think so. I think that, you know, God doesn't put us in situations to fail. But there's that last little section. You should be able to do it, but does that necessarily mean you will? See, God knows whether you can do it or not. And of course, if we do fail in a trial, where are we going to have to look? Right here. Right here. Okay, and then the second part there on the top of page 3, which the Lord has promised. Now, you remember in Hebrews 5, what did he say about these promises of God? No, chapter 6, Hebrews 6. Two immutable things.
God cannot lie.
God can't lie. He swore with an oath. So, is this tied to the swearing with an oath? The Lord promised those who love him. What do we say on Sunday night? When you're baptized into Christ, whose seed do you become? Abraham's seed. And that's what this promise is for, so that we might have hope, so that we might be able to understand. So God wants us to have a crown of life. And of course, he ties something interesting here. If you endure trials, what does that prove about your feelings toward God? Because where's this? The Lord has promised to those who what? Those who love him. So if I can endure trials, what does that mean? I love God. If I don't endure trials, what does that mean? Then I don't love God. Because, you know, we've talked about this so often, we have fair weather friends. If you won't go through a severe trial with me because you just say, I can't be bothered with this. I like you when you were bringing things to the relationship, but now there's nothing in the relationship, so bye-bye. And then maybe 2 months later I get better and you want to come back, and what's my thinking? Well, you've kind of shown your true colors. You don't really care about me. You just care about what I can bring to the relationship. Now, unfortunately, how many Christians are there who only care what God brings to the relationship? They don't really care about God. Well, how do you know? Well, you know when you still have a relationship with God, when those things are all taken away. And if we get the kind of persecution that it's looking like is just over the horizon, then we're going to find out pretty quickly who really loves the Lord and who doesn't, when it's going to cost you severely in order to maintain your relationship with God. It may cost you your liberty, may cost you your life. Do we get a better idea who loves God then? Yeah, that's when we find out. All right, any questions then on verse 12? Okay, verse 13 is a very fascinating verse because it opens up some vistas into some things that we need to think a lot about. So I think basically what he's doing here, we have two spiritual absolutes here. Now, when I talk about absolutes, we have gray areas, but do we like gray areas? I hate gray areas. I want things to be black or white. Because if they're black or white, what do I know? I know where I'm standing. If it's gray, then okay, well, I don't really know. Well, here's two spiritual absolutes. Number one, God has no part in temptation and sin. Absolutely none. And if so, what about this? Back in eternity, God picked who was going to be saved, who was going to be lost, and he allowed this total depravity. In other words, you were born a sinner. Well, whose fault is it if I'm born a sinner?
God's fault.
See, and so that's not possible. God will not do that. Virgil?
In my experience dealing with people, they do not understand the difference in God knowing beforehand what you're going to do and programming you so that you will or will not do it.
Right.
They do not understand that. And to try to convince them is a very difficult thing.
It sure is. And we've got centuries of false teaching on this. I mean, for years, so many years. The Catholics felt like if you couldn't get in the womb and baptize that baby and they were going to die, what was going to happen?
They'd be lost.
They're going to be lost. So babies are born what?
Lost.
They're born lost. They're born sinners. Well, whose fault is that? Well, it's Adam's fault. Well, no, I don't think you can pull that off. And so this is an absolute that we have no possible way. God has no part in temptation and sin. Now, the second absolute we won't get to until later in the book, but the second absolute is if anything good ever happens to you, where did it come from? Every good gift and every perfect giving has come down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow cast by turning. Now, that's a symbolic of the idea of what happens as the sun goes over and the colors shift and change. And with God, that's not possible. So we have two absolutes. Every good thing in my life is from God, and every bad thing in my life is not from God. And you say, well, wait a minute. Well, those are absolutes. And we've got to understand that. Now, God may allow. I mean, when God cursed the earth, why did he curse the earth? Was it his will to curse the earth? Or was it his response to our sin that caused him to curse the earth? So he's responding to us. Who's fully responsible? See, if I tell my son, if you take the car and you get a speeding ticket, I'm going to take the car away from you. Now I take the car away from you, and my son says, hey, you're not being fair. You took the car away. What do I say to him? You're the one who got the car taken away from me. I didn't take it away from you. Well, Dad, you took the key. Yeah, I know I did, but I told you, if you don't do this, you'll get to keep those keys. So who's responsible? So with God. And so let's go ahead then and jump into this thing. Now, the first thing I want to talk a little bit about, it's not super critical, but I just found it fascinating, is there's two Greek words for say. And one is just articulated language, whether you're really thinking about it or not. And the other one, lego, which is the concept behind logos. In the beginning was the word was with God, the word was God. This word has substance. This speech has substance. So when I'm preaching, it's always going to be lego. When I'm just talking, it's going to be laleo. So in this case, he uses the word lego, which means this is reasoned speech. This is not just somebody in a world of hurt saying, God did this to me. This is much deeper than that. This is someone who's thought it through, and this is the conclusion that they've drawn. Not that it matters, because the other would be just as wrong, but I just found it interesting that this term has a pretty strong connotation to it of reasoning. In other words, there's thoughts behind these words. These are not just thoughtless words. These are not just words coming out because of emotional duress. These are words that have been thought through, and this is a conclusion I've drawn based on the evidence that I've assessed. And that's when I start using the word lego instead of laleo. So, and I'm going to, well, yeah, let's skip over that mayday. So I'll talk about that a little more when we get further on. So let's go ahead and turn to page 4. We must never allow any internal reasoning to lead us to a conclusion that somehow God is responsible. Now, it's easy to do. When you've been fighting a temptation year after year after year and you just can't seem to break it, what's your temptation to say?
God's responsible.
God made me like this.
The devil made me do it.
Well, no. This is God. That's a different thing.
But it's even another cop-out.
But we'll see that's not true either. So the inner reasoning that leads me ultimately to the conclusion, I can't do anything about this. This is beyond me. Is that true? Is that a true statement? No, it's not a true statement at all. We can't, it's like, where's that verse that says, why did you make me like this? Oh, that's in Romans 9, isn't it? Why'd you make me like this? And what's the answer to that? See, that's why these are two absolutes. What do I know? Why did God make me like this? Because every good gift and every perfect giving comes from where? God. That comes from God. That's why he made me like this. Why am I like this? Well, because, and James will tell me in just a minute, but I'm never to say I am tempted by God. Now, I put this preposition in here. You don't have to spend much time on it, but it's again, the logic behind every word in this section is very interesting to me. And so he uses the preposition, and I went ahead and bolded what I wanted you to see. It has the idea of origin or cause. So where is the origin? Can the origin of my temptation be in God? Can the cause of my temptation be in God? That's what James is saying. Don't you ever say that the reason this happened is the source and the origin is in God. He is not the impelling or moving cause. He is not the efficient cause. He is not the cause at all. And the statement here is very clear because, and then of course we have that word gar, which we've talked about so many times now, the reason or cause for a previous statement. I know God can't be tempted, I can't be tempted by God because what can't God be done? God cannot be tempted by evil. Literally, he is untemptable. It's the alpha privative in front of temptation. So when you put the alpha privative in front of something, you deny it absolutely and completely. So God is not temptable. Now, let me read this paragraph, because I spent a lot of time this afternoon pondering this and trying to put it down in a way that made sense. It is something foreign to his being and nature. Because he himself is untemptable, it would never enter his consciousness to want it for another. Think of the implications here. When God created us, we were in his image and after his likeness. He wanted us to be just like him. It is therefore not possible that he could be involved in something like this, because if we get involved in sin, what do we change into? We're not like him at all. Because this is not a part of his being. We were made to be carbon copies of God. Now, not to the degree, of course, but in the sense that let's make man after what? Our own image and our own likeness. But God can't be tempted with evil, so what does that mean? Can't come from him. Can't come from him. Now, there's another part to this as well. Let me read the rest of this. He wanted us to be just like him, therefore it is not possible that he could be involved in something like this. Added to this is the agape love, that is the core of God's being. Since evil leads to eternal punishment, it too would be against his nature. Remember in 1 John, what does John say about God is love? He is love. He is the embodiment. He is the essence. That's how he lives. And so how could God even think about tempting us with evil? And of course, what's the answer? Not possible. So let me read a little bit more there at the very bottom of page 4. When we act according to his nature, it is always good and wholesome. This very nature of evil is something foreign and wrong. It makes him sick for anyone to do evil. He cannot do it himself, never feels the desire to want to sin or seek to make anyone else feel that way. It is simply impossible for him to do it. And the term James chose for evil is the exact opposite and antithesis. I didn't put it in here, but I found that in one of the lexicons today, that the Greek word kakos and the Greek word agathos. Agathos means something that's very good. So if you name somebody agatha, what does that mean? They're very good. But if you call them kakos, well, we have a word close to that. I won't talk about it, though. But anyway, it is the exact opposite. So these two are polar opposites, evil and good. Is God good or is God evil? See, God is good, and God created us to be good, and everything he made was good. Evil was not here, not a part of his being. It's absolutely impossible. So let's go ahead and go to page 5. Unequivocally, he himself does not tempt anyone. Now, there's two ways for the Greeks to say no. One is ooh, and the other is may. And you say, oh, who cares about all this stuff? Why do you keep bringing this stuff up? Well, because there's an interesting statement made. Let me read this one section. I got it pretty well bolded. It's the difference between may and ooh. He says, the may, a particle of negation, which differs from ooh, in that ooh denies the thing itself, or to speak technically, denies simply, absolutely, categorically, directly, and objectively, but may denies the thought of the thing, or the thing according to the judgment, opinion, will, preference of someone. So if I use the word may, I'm kind of giving you my opinion. If I use the word ooh, then I'm categorically denying it. And so that is not possible. And he never has. And he never will. If you're going to look for the source of temptation, don't look to God. It's categorically and absolutely denied that God could have anything to do with it. So again, it's black and white here. If you think something bad in your life came from God, then you are wrong. And not only are you wrong, but you are blaspheming, or at least speaking evil of God. You're attributing something to God that cannot be. And of course, the other problem with this, once we blame it on God, what incentive do we have?
None.
Because what can we do about it?
Nothing.
Once God did it, there's nothing I can do. And so a lot of people live in their temptations and in their weaknesses because they feel like this is how God made me, and there's nothing I can do about it. This is how I am, and that is just absolutely not true at all. Now, it's interesting the direction that James takes here. And so we might think, okay, well, it didn't come from God, so where'd it come from? Well, it must be Satan, right? Well, where does he say it comes from?
Speech.
We originated it. Now, the devil did offer Eve an opportunity. He put something in her mind that may or may not have ever been there before. I don't know if she'd ever thought like that. But the point is, what was out there, what could she do with it? She could, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to be like God. I'm happy. I'm as near to God as I want to be right now because God created me in his image and after his likeness. I don't need that. But what it says is, she saw the tree was what?
Good
for food. Now, does Satan say anything about that? She saw that it was desired to make one wise. Well, the devil did mention that. But what about the good for food and the delight to the eyes? Where'd those two come from? See, she devised those. And I suspect that she devised the other one, desired to make one wise. So James skips Satan completely, and he lays it at the feet of each one of us. So you created your temptations. You created them yourself. We've talked about this in the past, about opening a door. When each one of us grew up, some of us opened that door into drugs, some of us opened doors into alcohol, some of us opened doors into covetousness or anger or jealousy or sexual things, and some of us didn't. When you read all the lusts of the flesh in Galatians chapter 5, most of us are not interested in 90% of them. Never activated. Never been interesting before. Well, how did the ones we have get activated? Well, first of all, evil companionship. We open any doors because of evil companions we never would have thought of if they hadn't come into our life? Well, I think there's a few that we'd have to say, well, yeah, I think that evil companionship created some of these things. But could I have said no? I mean, I had a lot of evil companions growing up, and most of them didn't affect me at all because it made me sick what they were doing. Why? What's the difference? Why would I say, this makes me sick, and I really like this? Why do we do that? Because if we were all to tell each other what our sins were tonight, what would most of us feel about your sin? Yeah, it makes me sick. You make me sick. And you look at me, and what do you say? You make me sick too. Well, why do we pick things that are so sickening to other people? And of course, I don't have an answer for that. I mean, that goes a little deeper. But who decided whether we'd like it or not?
We did.
And so each one, now that's an interesting term. It means a totality in a distributive sense, which means everyone has this, but each one individually. This is not a collective thing at all. This is an individual thing. It's highly specialized. Each one of us is a unique individual with certain hereditary traits, certain abilities, certain knowledge, certain strengths that we have from our parents because of heredity. And then, of course, what does environment do? Evil companionship corrupts good morals. And if you are surrounded by godly parents and godly people who are directing you and teaching you wisdom and understanding, then what is your environment going to be? So don't say, oh, I don't believe in heredity and environment. Well, I definitely believe in heredity and environment. What's tough to figure out is whether I got it from my parents through my genes or whether I got it from watching them as I was growing up. How could you figure that out? So, but be that as it may, we are all a unique combination of emotions and strengths and weaknesses compounded with the evil companions that we grew up with. And so we don't look at temptation as a class. That's what James is doing here. It's an individual thing. Each one of us individually specialized our own temptations. And so every temptation is looked at from an individual's perspective. That being so, can it be Satan's fault or God's fault? No, we did it. We created our own cell. We created our own evil. We created our own temptations by the choices that each one of us made. And so we are, again, this unique combination. And so he then goes on to say that this temptation... Well, hang on a minute, because let me get my... Okay, so... Verse 14, each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. You know, I wanted to make a point on that, and I didn't. So let's go back to that on the bottom of page 5. I want you to see the word flow in the English and the word flow in the Greek, because I think it's important that we see how it's flowing in the Greek. So the top one, each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own lust and enticed. That's how we have to say it in English. But here's how the Holy Spirit said it. Each one is tempted of his own lust, drawn away and enticed. Does that sound a little different than the first one? Just a little bit different. Where does it all come from? Of his own lust. Okay, let's look at that word of. It's on the top of page 6. It's the Greek word hupo, which in the genitive, and this is in the genitive, means the efficient cause as that under the power of which an event is conceived as being. So where does God say the efficient cause is of temptation? It's out of your lust. It's directly out of your desire that you created. This isn't something God did. God did not. I don't even think God gave us the proclivities, the possibilities. I think we created our own circumstances based on the choices we made and the things we gave into and the things that we personally like. As I say, we had evil companions who became thieves or they became drunkards or they became sexual perverts, and they didn't affect us at all. We weren't interested in that. Why not? Because we all uniquely created our own lusts. We all created what it is that tempts us. And I suspect that if God were able to do this, and I don't know that I'd want to know it, but if God could show us the individual nature of everyone's temptation, we might find it's like a snowflake. What do they tell us about snowflakes?
They're all different.
No two are alike. And I got a feeling that that's what we did. We're just like a snowflake. We created our own circumstances and our own lusts. Rob?
And this tells me that that it's important for us to do self-examination and to look at origins of things, lust, sin, because a lot of times it's, as you brought out, it's cultivated, it's brought upon over time, and that when we understand that we're responsible, then we can also be in charge of fleeing from those things, doing away with those.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And then the Bible also gives us Philippians 4 and other verses, things to think on, but to replace those evil thoughts.
Well, and that's right. And of course, the purpose of all of this is to help us gain responsibility back. If I'm responsible for it, then who can fix it?
So,
if it started with me, I can stop it. I'm the guy who created my specific weaknesses, thoughts, temptations. And it all comes out of. So the source, the efficient cause of temptation is my lust or your lust, right?
And I think that's what's so amazing about God's promise to always, to never allow us to be tempted above that we are able, right? So, I mean, we're drawn away of our own lust, but he's never going to allow it to be so strong that we cannot resist.
Right.
He gives us the way of escape. And that's a pretty amazing promise if you think about it. Because we got ourselves into that mess, if you will. But God's not, gives us a way out, if you will.
That's a good point. But then I've sat down with people before. I had a good friend in Oroville. This was probably 30 years ago. And he had been sneaking next door for years and years. Mom and Dad were Christians. He'd be sneaking next door and getting into their pornography. And by the time they were 13 or 14, they were already messing around with homosexuality. By the time I met him, he was in his 30s. And his mind was just seething with this stuff. Just completely filled with it. Now, how did that happen? He let it happen. But can you let it happen to a point where you can't find your way back anymore?
Well, your conscience gets so seared it no longer bothers you. So, yeah, you can become so debased.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, but why is he so much weaker than everyone else? Because of his choices. Because of his choices that he made. And, of course, you know, this caused me years ago to come up with this illustration. Every time we do something, we put another cord that's tying us to this activity. And after I've got 3,000 or 4,000 of them, what's it starting to look like? You know, they're tiny little threads. But you get 3,000 or 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 of them, which is what some people have committed this sin that many times or this lust that many times. Now we're going to break it. Now, if you have to break it the same way you made it, how long is it going to take you?
It's going to be a while.
So you've got to break them. And that's what people don't like doing. The pain of saying no is not nearly as pleasurable as the joy of saying yes. And so if you have to say no as many times as you said yes, it can be very painful. But that's the process, Rob.
And also, I'm sure you will add that God can help us through that. I mean, that's the difference between being a Christian and the world. The world has no answers. And this comes back to, you know, James 1:5 about those that lack wisdom. And so God can help give us, he's the answer, he's the remedy to sin and how we can, with his help and our desire,
right,
together.
And of course, that's what the gospel is. They're our toolkit. There are tools in there, like repentance, like poor in spirit and mourning. The more you mourn over a sin, the less likely you are to want to jump right back into it again. And so you start developing that hatred for sin. All right, Ray?
Just relating to the devil and Eve in the garden, God gave everyone attributes, you know, like you can see, smell, taste. And the devil took God's word and twisted the meaning and appealed to her physical, you know, the things that she can taste, she can smell, it's appealing to her.
Right. No,
we're just doing the same thing every day, and we have enough intellect to do the things. Well, I like chocolate, but you're supposed to like smell. You know, we can make our choices.
Right. But see, the point I want us to keep from doing, and I know you're not doing that, but when we start talking about the serpent, when Satan said, when Eve said, it's the serpent, what did God say?
Oh, no.
No, it's you. You take responsibility for what you did. Eve, Adam said, it's the woman. Eve said, yeah, that you gave it. Oh, really? This is all your fault. Okay, but anyway, the point is that we have to take responsibility. We're not victims. We're not victims from something God did or what Satan did or what my mom and dad did. We are victims of what we allowed into our minds and the way that we chose to perceive things. I've met people who have gone through terrible circumstances, and they're the most patient, loving, compassionate people. And I've met other people that are so bitter that they can't even stand to look at anybody. Well, what's the difference between them?
They handle
it. Yeah, they're choices. They're choices. You know, we talked about sun on concrete, sun on butter. Is your heart going to be butter or concrete? Well, that's your choice. You didn't get a concrete heart. You didn't get a butter heart. You have to make it that way. All right. I sure wanted to get through these last two words, but we'll have to save them. So we'll pick up. I'm not going to spend a lot of time. Well, I say I won't. I always do. Anyway, we'll see how it goes next week. We'll cover these other two verses, but or two words. Thanks a lot, everybody. Appreciate it.